Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Big news in the newspaper world last week. Two big papers were sold, the Boston Globe and the Washington Post, with the Post going to Amazon's Jeff Bezos. All of this, of course, raises new questions about the future of the American newspaper. The relatively cheap sales prices said one thing, but the fact that visionary people, including Warren Buffett, are still buying them perhaps said something on the plus side. We'll talk about that and the question of how should local outlets prioritize local versus national stories? How do they do that? And what happens when sources won't discuss the news? It seems like it's happening more and more these days. With us today are our media critics. Peggy Lowe is a reporter and editor for Harvest Public Media. She's a former print reporter as well. Peggy, nice to have you.
Good morning,
Welcome
Steve.
Back. Derek Donovan is a public editor for the Kansas City Star. Derek, good morning.
Always good to be here.
Pam Fine holds the night chair for news, leadership, and community, and is a professor of journalism at the University of Kansas. Pam, nice to have you, too.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, so the sale of two of our largest leading newspapers last week, the Boston Globe and the Washington Post, what do you make of it, Derek, and what does it say for the future of the American newspaper? 20 words or less.
Right. One of my favorite comments that I've seen about it has been articulated by a few people, that there's maybe a sense that newspapers are in the future going to be, sort of be a little prestige, something for rich people to own, basically, kind of a feather in their cap.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a recognition of the fact that what we call newspapers, they're really media companies today, offer something that is relatively unique in that they are still trying to report the news in an objective, fair kind of way with as many broad resources as possible. But we're also understanding that that business model has altered so radically over the past 15, 20 years that, you know, maybe we're going to see some of the fat cats stepping up to say, I'm going to even put some of my own money behind it.
Yeah. You know, Pam, how did you take this news? I mean, as I said in the intro, on one hand, the fact they're being bought, newspapers are being bought, is a good thing, but the sales prices were on the pitiful side. How did you read it?
Well, I'm thrilled with these purchases. I think that we need deep-pocketed owners who have the wherewithal to experiment and allow the time it will take to transform from the printed revenue model to a digital model. And
mm-hmm.
We're seeing that transition now, but it's a slow transition, and these guys have the wherewithal to let things unfold and are not beholden to stockholders.
Yeah. Well, you know, Peggy, Pam's excited. Are you excited by this?
Oh, sure. I'm excited. And I would like to think, as you suggested, that this would be a prestigious move for deep-pocketed guys. That said, I think there's a growing recognition that media companies aren't profitable. You know, are we moving to a model that it's going to be public media now? You know, that media companies don't have to make a profit. They might be headed up by these angel investors. You know, the LA Times and the Chicago Tribune are up for sale, too. So I thought that was a very interesting thing that we just have not yet, as you said, Pam, that we're trying to make this transition to digital. We have not yet figured out a way to make it profitable.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment, Derek, because this question of profitability or not is something, of course, that we talk about a lot in our newsroom at the Kansas City Star. And there's one school of thought that says that, you know, the paper itself is actually pretty darn profitable. It just happens to be owned by a company, in this case, McClatchy, that purchased the Star at the exact wrong moment when the newspaper industry really began to go into steep decline. McClatchy bought the chain from a chain called Knight Ritter back in the day. And so you wonder, you know, is the paper making money, but maybe it's not making enough money to pay off the purchase price, given the fact that the value of these papers has gone south in recent years.
Right. One of the downsides to Wall Street investing in newspapers is that really all they care about is the year over year, like any other investment, which is perfectly natural if you are an investor. And there was a bit of a perfect storm over the newspaper industry over the past 15, 20 years. In the mid-90s, I'm sure a lot of people remember the community tabloid sections that all newspapers had been publishing expanded to a huge degree. I believe the Star at one point had 13 of those, if not more. And that was something that was a a grand experiment in very local, hyper-local reporting in print back then, because that was, of course, before the commercial web was available. It didn't pan out. It didn't pan out for anybody at all, because at the end of the day, people are not interested in that hyper-local news with the resources that it takes to produce it in a mainstream newspaper kind of way. There's just not the audience for it.
Hmm.
And so you had that buildup, the enormous buildup in the newspaper industry just at the time that the web was introduced, and this whole new model of looking at things and how we're going to distribute the news has changed. And it's all been plopped on the newspaper industry's lap at the same time. So even if the web had never come along, I don't think those community papers were ever going to really take off into the huge business that people at one point were predicting. So you had an industry that had gotten so big over the 80s and the 90s, and then it's kind of the 1-2 punch of the web.
But no question about it, the Kansas City Star is making money.
And I have a friend whose dad works in the grocery industry, where they're elated if they have a quarter a percent, a half percent margin. Mm-hmm. You know, newspapers make margins mm-hmm. much better than that still today. But they're not the margins that they were making back in the late 80s.
And the late 80s, it was something like 11%, right?
If
now
not
it's
more.
Lower. Yeah, so they were really making a ton of money.
Yeah, a whole lot more. That's the issue, though, right? Isn't it, Pam, that, you know, papers are making money, but they've taken on so much debt in some cases, these corporations, that paying off that becomes the issue in such a big way.
Yeah, debt is a huge issue, but so is infrastructure. Newspapers have large staffs relative to anybody yeah. else in the community. The cost of printing and distribution is high. So there are 1,400 newspapers in this country. There are a lot of newspapers. And I disagree with Derek a little bit in that I think people are interested in local news. The difficulty is that the one-off paper in a small community or even a large community has a lot of expenses. And especially when the economy's in trouble, the yeah. retailers can't pony up as much money for advertising. The other thing that's happened in many industries, including the newspaper industry, because of the web, is fragmentation. There are a lot of ways advertisers can get their messages to audiences without the newspaper as the intermediary.
Mm-hmm.
And so the competition is steep and the cost to reach audiences is high.
You know, it's maybe worth at this point talking about some of these financial numbers. I mean, when the Post sold for $250 million, that was one thing. The Boston Globe sold for $70 million, if I have these numbers right. And the Boston Globe had been purchased just years before by the New York Times for multiples of that number. Am I right, Derek?
Yeah, and I'm trying to remember. Do you?
It's in the billion-dollar range, I think.
Yes, yeah, 1.4, 1.6. I was at the Star Tribune in Minneapolis as a managing editor in 2003. I left. But before that, the Coles family had sold to McClatchy, which, as you said, yeah. owns the Star. And the purchase price was $1.2 billion. Mm-hmm. The last time the paper sold, it was less than half that.
So that begins to speak to the declining values here, the steep decline in values that we're seeing. You know, Peggy, you think we're going to have an American newspaper? Is it going to be around 10 years from now? What's your sense?
I think the big ones will. You know, I do think that the legacy papers like the Washington Post, the New York Times, the LA Times, hopefully, will still survive. I do worry about these local papers. You know, you mentioned that Warren Buffett is now investing in them, and that's good news. He does actually, he's been quoted as saying he does believe there's some profit within these local papers. He bought a bunch in Nebraska and the World Herald, I think. And
yeah.
So that's good news. But I hope that there's some patient people. You know, Warren Buffett is known for being a very patient investor. So any investors in these local papers are going to have to be pretty patient, I think.
I was really struck by this comment just last week in Forbes with Bezos and Buffett buying papers these days. Forbes declared this: newspapers no longer look like obsolete dead tree sellers, but tomorrow's providers of high quality branded content. When you see smart people doing something you think is stupid, it's time to reevaluate your assumptions. I guess as a newspaper guy, Derek, I like the sound of that. That's a different kind of way of looking at it.
Well, it is. And I think that really these investors are looking a little bit further towards what really the infrastructure was. You know, as we were talking about a minute ago, the real infrastructure in a newspaper is two-pronged. You've got the traditional printing and distribution infrastructure, which is something that no two ways about it is going away in every publishing enterprise throughout the world, books, magazines, whatever it is. But then you've also got the infrastructure of the newsroom. And mm-hmm. the professionalized newsroom, whether it's at a newspaper or if it's an original digital site or a radio station, whatever it is, the principles of journalism are always there, and they're going to be applicable across platforms. And that is an inherent good, and that's an inherent value.
Hmm. What do you think? You think papers are going to be around 5 or 10 years from now?
Oh, I do. I think we're going to see the distribution model very, very different.
I mean, the actual printed newspaper on paper delivered to your front door.
Yeah, I'm obviously not a circulation maven here, but I can see a day when there's a printed newspaper that is distributed every day for free. And I think the newspapers might get out of the business of delivering them door to door, because that's really, you know, one of the biggest costs that a traditional print paper has.
Yeah. Peggy.
If you guys have read at all about the Orange County Register lately, I mean, you know, this is the new shiny object in journalism today. And I watch it, of course, because that was the paper I just came from 2 years ago, where I survived 10 rounds of layoffs and buyouts. You know, it was a really bad time. The paper went bankrupt.
I got you by 2 or 3, I think, at this point. Yeah, just for the record.
We're just survivors, aren't we?
Yeah.
And anyway, that paper went south in large measure because the family that owned it had a squabble and went different ways, and it ultimately went bankrupt. So it was really in large measure because of some bad business decisions. But now there's a new owner, and he is just beefing up staff. My friends who are still there are thrilled. He is starting a daily in Irvine and a daily in Long Beach, and they put up a paywall online, so that's going to be interesting. But they are investing more and more and more in local news. I think I would agree with Pam, too. Most reader surveys suggest over and over and over and over that they want more local news. That said, those community and suburban things went broke.
Yeah,
so that's a weird juxtaposition, isn't it?
Yeah, and Pam, I think you caught me in something that I didn't really mean to say. I do think people are very interested in that. It's just whether they can monetize it, whether they can sell enough ads to distribute those things in the numbers they want to is the question.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. This notion of paywalls, just so people understand, this is money you've got to pay to go online and spend some time on a newspaper site and read a number of articles. At some point, you've got to pay for the privilege of doing that. Is that working? Do we know if that's working across the industry?
Absolutely. All the companies that have transitioned to a metered system where you pay a certain amount for access, sometimes based on a certain number of hits, have seen their revenues go up. And those there were several holdouts in the industry, and now they're coming on board, because the key to success today for news organizations is diversifying revenue streams. Mm-hmm. And so they need audiences to pay for the product. They need audiences to buy products. They need audiences to attend events. And they're doing everything they can to monetize their organizations, their products.
So, Pam, so back in the mid-90s then, when newspapers had a decision to make, which was, do we charge for our content when the Internet was first exploding onto the national scene, or do we offer it for free? The industry opted for the free route, but it looks like in hindsight, was that a mistake?
Well,
given the layoffs, given the turmoil of the last few years?
Yeah, probably, but I think they were waiting for enough of an audience to make it worthwhile so that they could sell those eyeballs to advertisers. And
yeah,
that's the name of the game.
So you had to build up an audience first, get people into the habit of reading papers, and then turn around at some point and begin to charge for them.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Let me get our listeners involved here. What do you think the future of the American newspaper is? Do you expect to see your Kansas City Star on your doorstep being delivered each morning 5 or 10 years from now? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email address is UpToDate at kcur.org, or you can also tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. We're visiting this morning with our very good media critics. There was another big development in the news last week. We're talking about local content, and that was AOL's decision to shutter 400 local news sites belonging to something called Patch. That's the company that tried to organize a bunch of local news operations in towns all across the country. So even the push towards local news didn't seem to be working, at least as far as Patch was concerned. What do you make of this development, Peggy? Is this something that's a harbinger of things to come or not?
This has been highly, highly watched. When AOL jumped in and said, okay, we're going to go hyper-local big time.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to put all, you know, in Southern California where I used to live, there were dozens of reporters in all the little suburbs covering every little pothole, you know, every little city council meeting. And people were really excited about that. And it has kind of failed miserably, in part, I think, because it has turned out to be sort of a sweatshop for some reporters. They're working like 15-hour days for next to nothing. What they cover may not be the brightest things to cover, that kind of thing. And then did you guys hear the news this morning about when the chief of AOL was on the line on a telephone conference call talking to his people about these are coming, all these layoffs, but hey, we're going to stick in there. And he fired a guy who was taking a picture of him.
I did see that.
His creative director. And it kind of, to me, I thought, well, now I see what his decision-making process is like. And you kind of have to question it because instantaneously he fired
this guy.
This
was in the room with the head of AOL. He was listening to the conversation. He shot a phone picture of him.
Right.
And the head guy didn't
because
like
they always put those on their website. It's kind of part of his job. And he got fired for it. And the best part is that Romanesco called him and he said from a local bar he had no comment.
I think the criticism of Patch in terms of its business strategy was too much, too fast, and that it went into markets that couldn't produce the business that it needed to keep going. So the smart money says go and do places that there's obvious retail gains possible and produce quality content. So I think they need to do better in terms of the product they're producing, but also make smart business decisions.
And no question, Patch is still continuing, right? They've just downscaled their operation rather substantially.
Right, but some of the smartest thinkers are questioning whether it can continue much longer, that this may just be the beginning of the end. But Armstrong, as Peggy said, is saying, no, he's going to keep this thing going.
The
They're
head
committed
of AOL.
To it. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I thought when they first came out with this whole idea that it was a surefire winner. It just made a lot of sense to me that
Steve.
It might work. And what did I know?
I saw it as a digital replay of the community newspapers from the mid-90s.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not at all saying that the smaller towns, you know, you think about Kansas City, you think about Gladstone, you think about Roland Park. I'm not saying that interesting news doesn't happen there, but whether there's really going to be enough news to report of value to have somebody full-time covering those beats, I just don't see it.
There is a success story locally. The Prairie Village Post seems to be a very effective sort of micro-operation that we're talking about here. It's been up for a few years and, by all accounts, seems to be doing rather well.
And they've cultivated an audience, and I think that's great. And I don't know that much about Prairie Village myself. I would tend to suspect that there's probably a hardcore group of people who follow it very closely. And, you know, you're right. They have cracked the code. And whether a big company is going to be able to do that for every community around, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, they've cracked the code, but they're not making tons of money. I mean, this is a, one or two-man operation. It's not very large. So you're talking about the difference between thousands, maybe into the six figures, and millions with something like the Kansas City Star.
These aren't full-time jobs either. I think they also do other things, have other occupations besides putting out the Prairie Village Post. So,
I like the Seattle model, and I think it's what has to happen. And in Seattle, the Times, the major newspaper there, works with dozens of community sites, many of whom are bloggers, to offer the wider community audience news that is both hyper-local and more regional. And I think the organizations that are successful are doing a good job partnering so they don't have to own the costs of personnel.
So then they don't pay those bloggers in Seattle?
No. The win-win is that the bloggers' content appears on the main newspaper site and that they can also, the bloggers can link to the stars. So there's a win-win in which if someone is very interested in local or neighborhood news, they can access it through the blog site, or they can come to the Star and get a range of neighborhood sites easily accessed to them.
Well, speaking of sharing content, Peggy Lowe, you work for something called Harvest Public Media here at KCUR, and you guys are doing a whole lot of that. Your work appears in the Star and where else? Lots of other places, right?
We have six partner stations here in the Midwest, in Missouri, Colorado, Illinois, Nebraska, Kansas. Did I name them all? And so they appear on all of our public radio stations. And yeah, because our editor, Donna Vestal, is a former editor from the Kansas City Star, our stuff appears in the Star as well. And that typically is they will take the stories that we've done and run them in the business section. That said, we did an investigative series with Mike McGraw and some of the other folks at the Star about a look at the beef industry. So yeah, we're all about collaboration. And we just continue to talk more and more and more about it. I mean, we're going to start collaborating with some folks we think in Colorado on some energy coverage, and it's how we do business now.
Okay. 816-235-2888, the future of American journalism, the American newspapers, our topic here, our email address, update@kcur.org. Mike from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Yes. I'm not commenting on the future of the newspaper, but what my comment is I hate to see the newspaper disappear because I don't think there's anybody else left to investigate politicians and other forms of corruption. And I think what, you know, with the, and pardon me, and I understand the Star situation, meaning like all the other newspapers, they don't have as much money today to spend as they used to, but, anyways, I don't know. The politicians ought to be cheering with the demise of the newspapers because they're going to have a free day.
Well, Mike, you're preaching to the choir here.
Yeah, you know.
Thanks, Mike. Yeah.
You know, Mike, you point out something that is one of the big beneficiaries of the era of the big newspapers is that they've been able to throw a lot of resources at some of those investigations, which are very time and labor intensive things to do. And one of the biggest downfalls to going to a concept of a one- or a two-man shop, that's not at all to say that somebody who is an independent journalist, you know, such as a blogger, can't do good stuff. But you really have to have a lot of resources to throw at some of those bigger things. And also, one of the things about those stories is they are highly collaborative a lot of the time just within the newsroom and all of the checks and balances that go into that kind of thing, which smaller organizations do not have by definition. Mm-hmm. And here I am putting my ombudsman hat on for a minute. The advantage of having a lot of different people touch those things, particularly when you've got more than one reporter working on it and you've got a group of editors who are working on it, you have a lot better chances that you're going to end up with a balanced look at it or at least a very completely researched look at it that is just simply beyond the reach of a smaller organization.
And the larger organizations have the moral authority and the power to challenge, which is vitally important and often backed up by good law firms and deep pockets to pay those law firms to insist that the public's right to know is followed. So I think the public, Mike's comment, mirrors what we're finding in the public as a whole, that the public really appreciates watchdog coverage. They think that there's an important role. Unfortunately, they're not always willing to pay for it.
Yeah, and they don't recognize sometimes just how expensive it is to do some of the work that gets done down there, right? Yeah, absolutely. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email address is update@kcur.org. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation here with our media critics, and we'll turn to a topic of how young people are consuming the news these days and a whole lot of other topics as well, including the coverage, KCUR's coverage of a rape case up in Maryville and the station's decision to name the victim in this case instead of keeping that person anonymous, as has been the traditional practice in journalism for so many years. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed Friday's conversation about one of Kansas City's oldest black churches, you can find that and more information on all of our broadcasts at kcur.org. Freshly sharpened pencils, new notebooks, and teen hormones are in the air as Kansas City area students prepare to go back to school. Tomorrow on the show, psychologist Wes Crenshaw returns to talk about the teen dating culture. Well, this hour we're talking about the future of American newspapers, the future of the media, with our very good media critics, Peggy Lowe from Harvest Public Media, Derek Donovan from The Star, and KU's Pam Fine. Our phone number here again, 816-235-2888, and our email address is uptodate@kcur.org. You know, I guess, Peggy, if you stand back and look at all of this, the sort of the evolving media culture from 10,000 feet, it's pretty clear that the media world is evolving and is going to continue to evolve for a number of years to come, right? We're not going to recognize it in 10, 20 years from now.
Oh, absolutely not. You know, I think it's just like what we've been talking about this morning. We thought local papers and other papers were dead. Well, there seems to be a resurgence. So we just have absolutely no idea what's going to happen. And, I mean, I think that the one constant that we'll be looking for is, can these make a profit? Can we pay the reporters? You know, can we keep moving in that way?
Hope they can pay the reporters.
That's a very important thing.
Yeah. Dave from Lenexa. Dave, you're on Up to Date. Good morning. You there, Dave? Okay. He's not there. What do we know these days, Pam Fine, about how young people are consuming the news and how they're connecting to the world around them? What do we know about that, all of that?
Well, the big trend, of course, is social media.
Yeah.
Roughly, the studies show that 60% of the news that young people get is a result of shared links. So there are a core group of people who like to be opinion leaders and share links, and the rest of the young people and probably the rest of us are reading those as well. Young people don't follow the news day to day. They dip in and they dip out. And so one of the interesting points about running a local news organization is understanding that and making sure your coverage is devised to catch people up who may not be following things minute by minute or day by day.
Young folks didn't follow the news real closely when I was in college either. I mean, that hasn't really changed much. They have other things going on, right?
Yes.
The other
interesting thing is, though, that young people like branded content. They like to know who's behind the news they're getting. And so, again, I think that's a real opportunity for major news organizations who have credibility to reach younger audiences. But they have to revise their coverage so that it has plenty of context and that it doesn't assume that young people know what's being talked about.
That's an interesting word you just used, credibility. And you wonder with time, as more and more folks spend time on the internet and sort of ask this now age-old question, which is, how do you know what to believe on the internet if newspapers standing as at least an attempt of being credible day in and day out and trying to present something of a balanced picture, Derek, if that idea won't sort of increase in gravitas as we move on here a little bit?
I largely think the story's been written that everybody dismisses virtually everything they see on the internet as being at least suspect, if not fundamentally untrue.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've probably seen the great State Farm insurance commercial where the girl is talking about how she read on the internet, you know, all these things about insurance, and then this schlubby guy comes up and she said, this is my boyfriend. He's a French model. I met him on the internet. You know, that's the whole joke.
Yeah.
And I think that especially today's talking about, for example, college students, I think it's been drummed in them enough to realize realize that you have to be suspect. And I do think that that is a great opportunity for traditional media organizations to brand. However, you've also got the big brands on the internet, such as BuzzFeed, for example, that is really repackaging other people's content largely. Now, they've greatly expanded their reporting staff over the past year in particular, and they are producing some long-form type stories now. They're not getting read very much because if you look at BuzzFeed, it's a dynamically generated page, and you're seeing the stuff that's shared the most up near the top, and it reloads and refreshes every time you reload the page, and you're not seeing those long-form things stick to the top.
Yeah, so. It's like 10 cutest kitty pictures.
Exactly.
Stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of that these days. Yeah. Dave from Lenexa. Dave, you're back. Thanks for calling back.
Yeah, sorry about that. Hey, you may have touched on this, but I haven't heard the whole program. Was wondering if there is going to come a time when region cities such as St. Louis and Kansas City will be mere subsidiaries of New York Times or Washington Post. Distribution costs. I don't know how much of the whole paper scene is in that, but say, for example, I subscribe to New York Times and Kansas City Star. Most of the time, I think, when I look at the thin paper of the Kansas City Star, it could be just an insert in the New York Times.
Well, I'm glad you're buying two papers, Dave. That's near and dear to my heart. But, Derek, you want to take a whack at that?
Well, I will tell you that most national papers, and you're talking about the New York Times, USA Today, Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post are really the only ones that are truly national papers anymore. You could say LA Times as well. They're already printed and distributed by the major dailies in the cities that they appear in for the most part. You know, they're regionally printed, and then the same person who throws your Star is also throwing your New York Times. Whether the same company might own all of them someday, I don't know. Traditionally, though, newspapers independently, editorially, have always retained their own control. And so even though the McClatchy Company owns a number of newspapers, the idea that there's somebody in the corporate headquarters in Sacramento calling all the papers saying, okay, today you're going to write about this, you're going to write about this, that's just not the way the newspaper industry works. And if you saw the sausage being made late at night, you would realize it's virtually impossible to try to coordinate anything on a grand scale.
All right, Dave, thank you. Lewis from Springfield. Lewis, you're on Up Today. Good morning. You there, Lewis? Okay. Let's turn to this issue of how should local outlets prioritize local versus national news. It's something that I think the Star and local TV news outlets are dealing with all the time. I guess the question is, you know, to how much ink or airtime should be given to a national story like the Trayvon Martin case in a local news outlet when you know that the national news is all over the story. Derek Donovan, how does the Star sort of balance that ongoing concern, which is really a concern that we deal with every day, I guess?
Yeah, you know, in a story like that, you run the risk of being out of touch if you don't cover it at all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I argued in a column a few weeks ago, though, that story should never become a national story. That was a very sad local crime story that happened in Central Florida. And one of my ongoing themes, and I'm beginning to believe in this more and more every day, is that we want to apply meaning and symbolism and all these literary devices to news. Well, there's no literary device in news. This was something that happened between two people. If we turned it into a Law and Order episode, we could have all sorts of symbolism about what it means about race relations and that sort of thing. But at the end of the day, I think that's ultimately trivializing what really happened there by trying to make it into a narrative. But then when the cable news networks are covering it just full court press, you know, you look like, oh, the Star's not covering it because they don't want to wade into these waters. So it's a tough decision for editors to make.
You know, Pam, Peggy, there's this other story that came out not long ago. In fact, it's the subject of this new documentary that a lot of people are talking about, Fruitvale Station. I think it's showing at the Tivoli. And it documents the killing of Oscar Grant, who was black, by white police from the BART transit system out in San Francisco. But what struck me about this, of course, is that story has so many of the same elements as the Trayvon Martin Zimmerman case, but that didn't become the same type of huge news story that the Trayvon Martin story did. And it could have. Why didn't it?
Well, I think that, first of all, I have to disagree with you, Derek. I do believe Trayvon Martin was a very big national story, and here's why. This whole make my day, stand your ground, you know, those things, as Obama pointed out, can be inherently racist. Would that have worked for Trayvon Martin? I don't know. It worked for George Zimmerman. So I would suggest that that is a national story. The one in California, I watched it. I was living in California at the time, and there were protests and things like that, but it was just such an obvious, oh, my God. gosh, he just shot him. You know, it was on everybody's cell phones, and it was all over the internet. So it didn't take on the national significance until now, because that documentary is so good, and mm-hmm. it shows a day in the life of this young man.
Yeah, I agree with you, Peggy, that the Trayvon case, I think, did ignite a national discussion about profiling young black men. And so I think it was an important story. And if you look at it from the perspective of blacks in this country, I mean, they still feel that they have to be very, very careful when they're in all white neighborhoods. And I think this case really showed that problem. The other thing, the Fruitvale case seemed to have involved a transit police officer, where the Trayvon case was a guy who wanted to be a police officer, but was, you know, a neighborhood watch type. And so I think it allowed people to identify with him more easily and say, well, if I were in those shoes and I were concerned about my neighborhood and I saw this young kid in a hoodie walking through, would I be concerned? So I think the context, the circumstances were different enough that it made the Trayvon Martin shooting more universal.
Yeah.
May I add, though, that it does make me cranky sometimes when I read the Star and the local columnists write about national things, because I think there's so many great local things you could be covering.
Yeah.
And that does make me a little cranky. Now,
I struggle with that a lot covering politics. I mean,
sure.
My tendency has been to write about local stuff, figuring that there's tons of national stuff out there, so why bother? But
right.
I understand the temptation sometimes.
Right. Mary Sanchez had a great column today about Chris Kobach traveling around the country, making a lot of money, you know, with these anti-immigration bills. And
right.
so I thought that was a really good column. But, yeah, I would say that I look for my national news somewhere else.
And the smart local news editors make the connection and bring the national to local, or make the local story as big as possible, so that you recognize or realize what the impact of those national issues are at home.
And that goes back to Pam's earlier good point about fragmentation. Part of the reason that these things become the lingua franca, these big, big stories, is because that's the only thing that CNN and Fox News has that they can broadcast that everybody can identify with.
Yeah.
Even somebody on the national stage like Chris Kobach, only the wonks know who he is. So CNN's not going to devote their time to it. So it's a great criticism, Peggy.
I call it Fruitvale Station a documentary. It's actually a drama based on a real story, so
there's a fine
line there. Back to some calls here. Let's go to Barbara from Overland Park. Barbara, good morning.
Well, good morning. Great program. I just want to bring up something that makes me sound like a troglodyte, I guess, but that is the old Joni Mitchell song, "You Don't Know What You Got Till It's Gone." And I think giving up some of our old institutions and traditions, we better think long and hard about it. I heard about a family in Long Island over the weekend that lost all of their family treasures, including pictures and artifacts, in the hurricane. An example of another thing that now they're gone. Also, I just want to say that I'm legally blind, and so every day I issue up a prayer for National Public Radio and all the good radio stations that keep me informed.
Well, Barbara, great call, and now I've got that song in my head for the rest of the day. Thanks so much for calling in. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's turn to another issue that this radio station dealt with not too long ago, and that's KCUR did a series of reports based on a rape case in Maryville that wasn't prosecuted. That was the whole point of the stories. In the course of doing those pieces, the station named the victim, which isn't the usual practice. And, Peggy, you were very much involved in these stories. Why did you guys go that way, and what was the fallout from that decision, if there was one?
The other reporter on this, Monica, and I decided early on that because this story really came up, you know, bubbled up from the ground, it was one of the young girl's mothers who actually kind of came out of the closet, as it were, on wanting to get some coverage of this story. And so we took a long look at it, and it took many months, but ultimately what we did is we talked to the mothers, and there were two girls involved in this alleged rape. They were 13 and 14 at the time. So we went through their moms and talked to them a lot about it. One of the families, the Colemans, decided to, you know, be named. The other family did not want to be named. And so we honored both of those things. And basically it came down to let's honor the the daughter's decisions. Let's honor the mother's decisions.
But that, again, that breaks tradition of what newspapers and other media outlets have so often done over the years, which is not to name under any circumstance.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we've really seen an evolution in this, certainly since I've been in the business, when, you know, we have never in the past named rape victims. Then in the Des Moines Register, was it in the 70s, maybe early 80s?
Early 80s, yeah. Yeah.
Geneva Overholt, so they won a Pulitzer for that coverage.
The woman was named, right. And so I think it's kind of an evolution of the crime of rape and the evolution of thinking of it as shame.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way we went.
Pam, as a former managing editor yourself, do you have any problem or any question about a call like that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough one, but you take each case as it comes. You try to have bedrock principles, but in this case, they thought long and hard and decided that that was going to be the most effective, impactful way to tell the story. I think the important thing is to consider the impact, the idea that this girl is going to have to live with this for years and years to come. And do you feel that she and her family are making a considered decision and understand the implications of that decision? If you do and you feel that it's an important part of telling the story, I think you can go that way. Many editors still would not do that, because especially with a 13 or 14-year-old, if an adult woman made the decision for herself, that would be an easier decision.
May I add, though, too, is her name was really out there. It was all over Twitter. It was all over Facebook. And I don't think Daisy Coleman thought twice about saying, sure, I'm going to do this story. Hmm. Because for her, it was already out there. And this was a way for her to kind of set the record straight.
That's interesting. Well, and finally today, PBS has announced that it will feature two female anchors working side by side on its NewsHour for the first time in the history of TV journalism. Those anchors are Gwen Ifill and Judy Woodruff, they will also work as managing editors for that broadcast. How big a deal is this?
It's huge. I love it. It's wonderful, and it's a long time coming.
Yeah, too long in coming.
Why not early?
Too long in coming, but I'm happy to see it because they're so well qualified. I mean, there's no question that the decision was made based on the quality of their work, their track record, and I like the fact that now they're being given visibility as the top flight journalists they are.
Yeah. One more phone call here. Leslie from North Kansas City. Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning. Hey, listen, thanks for the topic. I've been watching a lot of this, and, you know, this may just be an old saw or whatever, and maybe Derek could speak to this, but what about the idea of newspapers as a public service? I mean, is there any media left in the universe that even pretends to offer that? To me, it seems like it gets lost in the shuffle, and they talk about buying these things like cash cows. They know they're not today, but I think when they bought them in the 80s, they assume they just keep increasing in value. And it's really not – is it really that kind of business?
Well, that's a great point. I think if you ask most people in newsrooms, that they would say that's their primary thing. You know, one of the sort of fundamentals is that you get into journalism kind of the same reason some people get into social work. It's that a lot of people feel as though it is a calling. And newspapers – or newsrooms are always in a weird tension because – you are responsible for creating news content. You're not really responsible for bringing in the revenue in any way, shape, or form in an ideal world. And so people are always worried that that is going to be the casualty, is that important journalism, if we get too much about the bottom line.
I want to thank our media critics today. Once again, Peggy Lowe, reporter and editor for Harvest Public Media, Derek Donovan, the public editor for the Kansas City Star, and Pam Fine, who's a professor of journalism at the University of Kansas. Thank you all for a great conversation today.
My pleasure.
Thanks for coming
in. Thank
you.
You bet.